You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Doreen Neshat speaks of the great Egyptian singer Umm Kulthum, the subject of her work In Progress, and she speaks of her as an artist who lived her life, quote, in juxtaposition to political reality. That's a phrase that also describes Neshat's provocative and poetic work, and one might add, the work of the late Robert Rauschenberg, who we'll be hearing about more tonight, too. In her photographs, installations, videos, and films, Neshat addresses issues of social repression among women in her native Iran and beyond. Through haunting allegory and imagery, she portrays women as complex individuals with desires and ambitions who move between intense private feelings and public life. Reaching beyond her own identity, she also addresses broader concerns about cultural beliefs and the power of the erotic. Neshat was born in Iran, leaving at the age of 17 to study art in the United States. She graduated from Berkeley in 1982, and when she returned to her country as an adult, she encountered a reality far from the one of her memory, and this discord inspired meditations on memory, lofts, and contemporary life in Iran, which are central to her work. She's received many awards for her work, among them the first international prize at the Venice Biennale in 1999, the Edinburgh International Film Festival, the International Center of Photography, and the Hiroshima Freedom Prize. Some of you were here a few weeks ago, I believe, to hear the great South African freedom fighter, Albie Sachs, who also worked with Nelson Mandela. It was right here in this room. And Shireen Neshat, like Albie Sachs, embodies the kind of truth-telling that we treasure here at the Los Angeles Public Library, an institution that is itself devoted to the free access to ideas and information, which is a very radical idea in the world today, always has been, always will be. And to add to the similarities, both Albie Sachs and Shireen Neshat are optimists. Through their actions and their work in the world, they give others the courage to face fraught situations of both political and cultural repression with imagination and creativity. I also have the great pleasure tonight of introducing Christy McClear, the founding executive director of the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation, a foundation which fosters the legacy of Robert Rauschenberg's life, work, and his philosophy that art can change the world. I had the great honor of being a Rauschenberg fellow this last year at the Rauschenberg compound on Captiva Island, and I can attest that Robert Rauschenberg's spirit of generosity and activism is palpable and potent to this day. You'll hear more about Robert Rauschenberg's philosophy in art and activism tonight. Now please join me in welcoming Shireen Neshat and Christy McClear to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Hi, everybody. How are you? I'm going to read some words, which is sort of horribly boring in a conversation, but you'll forgive me for that. And during the conversation, I actually have some great clips of Bob Rauschenberg speaking, and I brought them because in the last year, I've had a chance to become friends with Shireen, and I am honored. And I think that some of Bob's words have the same inspiration, and I'm sure that you will all find that after our time here tonight. And I just wanted to share with you some words from one of our board members. Shireen Neshat explores the cultural, social, and religious codes of Islamic societies and their effect on the female experience. A multimedia artist working in still photography and film, she incorporates traditional Islamic iconography into her work to create haunting and powerful images. I'll say that you create images where we can't even find words, that subvert our notions of female submission and actually translate into kind of an Islamic feminism. There is sincerity and authenticity in Nashat's work, which I think the art world has embraced. While her art focuses on the feminine experiences in Islamic societies, her work simultaneously reflects our globalizing culture and touches on our humanity. And that's from Aggie Gund, who's head of our philanthropy committee, and she sends her best to you. So I thought what would be so nice is for us to see your work and become familiar with it if you're not already.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say thank you to the Broad Foundation, Ed Patutu, and also Ken Brecker at the Los Angeles Public Library to host this event. Thank you, Christy, for joining me from New York. You know, I would like to have this evening for conversation, and there's a lot to discuss, but I thought I could share with you a little bit of a background in how my work has developed to be considered political art or politically charged or politically conscious art. But I also want to point out while we're here that my work I consider also emotionally charged, and I think I would like to just, before we get into the conversation, run by you the way in which my personal life history, my personal circumstances, both emotionally and politically, have been integral in my point of view, in the way in which I frame the questions and narratives and concepts, and visually the way I create. And so as I go through this, in bold points, my personal history, I want you to recall, the emotional and political context that I've undergone. Not that my work is actually autobiographical, but just to put in context the personal history of artists in the way that sort of shapes their point of view. I came to this country in 1975 by the choice of my family. We lived during the Shah monarchy, a rather liberal time. My family were more or less middle class. We had a very comfortable family situation. I came to Los Angeles, actually, with my two sisters. And the intention was that I would go back rather quickly. But to our surprise, in 1979, we had the Islamic Revolution. And maybe it was not a great surprise, but nevertheless, the Islamic Revolution transformed the Iranian society. And what happened immediately after, of course, was the breakdown of the relationship between U.S. and Iran. And immediately after, the hostages were taken for 444 days, and that basically the doors closed down between Iran and U.S. While I was only 17, actually, at the time, studying here in Los Angeles as a high school. Just in 1980, the war broke down between Iran and Iraq, which lasted over 8 years. And this pretty much defined my separation. At this time, my two sisters who were with me already returned to Iran. So not to be melodramatic, but again, I, as a young woman, I found myself completely isolated from Iran as the doors literally politically closed. And in fact, at some point, the airports were closed. You couldn't even make phone contacts. So I basically didn't see my family until 1990. At this time, I was studying art at UC Berkeley, and when I look back, you know, I was really a bad student. I actually became completely distracted because the timing of my studies paralleled with the revolution, and I was literally handicapped and paralyzed, and I never even realized it at the time. I developed anxiety attacks. I had to see doctors, and then finally everyone said, you know what, there's nothing wrong with you. You are in state of anxiety. And needless to say, I had to survive financially, emotionally, and also be a parent to myself. Only just building up to what's coming up, by 1990, I basically graduated, moved to New York. I decided that I would not want to be an artist. I had no interest in it. I was not interested in the education. I moved to New York to start life over again. I had a child. But I was able to return to Iran in 1990 after literally 12 years of not seeing the family. The strangest thing was that I arrived as an Iranian artist in diaspora with, not artist anymore, but Iranian with a Korean-Iranian baby. And meanwhile, the country had really transformed to my eyes from what I remember, the Persia, the culture we had, to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this experience, without going into too much details, because I want to leave more time for a discussion, became the most transformative experience I've had in a decade. And it compelled me to go back to make work, which somehow was the only way that I could delve into my own anxieties as a human being, as a woman who literally felt disconnected. And art became actually an excuse, a way in which I could engage this and sort of lose this feeling of displacement, this idea of nostalgia, to integrate in a community that I had left for so long. And not only that, they had endured the war with Iraq, the Islamic Revolution, the atrocities of the Islamic Revolution, the executions of our friends and the people who were actually my generation. And my family had changed profoundly from the time of I had known them, you know, people who were very progressive, Western, now with the veil, and they were just terribly sad people. Yet I found an obsession in returning to Iran and making work that somehow, not for the art world, again, because I didn't have an art career, but somehow it creates a space for me to maintain this relationship, even in New York. But by 1996, as I was traveling back and forth to Iran, I was banned from going to Iran. I don't know why, but somehow the government of Iran found me and my work problematic, and I had a very horrible experience in the airport in Tehran. That was perhaps one of the most frightening experiences I had. I eventually made a video called The Last Word. I went back to New York, and the doors closed again between me and Iran and my family for the most part. This is 1996. Now it's 2013. So from then on, I still see them occasionally in different countries. Again, I don't want to get too personal. I want just to get to the point of how this sort of defines my point of view. Finally, in 2009, we had the Green Movement, which was an incredibly powerful uprising by the people of Iran. Up to now, between my work produced while I was going to Iran and after, my work had grown already to become sharply critical of the government because my eyes had opened to the atrocities, but all on the outside, life in exile. But by 2009, I made the film Women Without Men, which was actually covering the period of 1953 when we had the coup by the American CIA in Iran, which sort of removed the democratically elected Prime Minister, Dr. Mossadegh, and brought back the Shah. As in this film, we showed the scenes of people's uprisings and fight for democracy, and we had the uprising in the streets of Tehran. So this film became immediately attractive for all Iranian people who somehow saw the history repeating itself. And more or less, the expectation in me now transforming from being politically charged artist to a politically active artist. Next thing I know, I was wearing green. I was in political protests. I was speaking in all kinds of television programs and things like that. And I organized and participated in a hunger strike in front of the UN, something that I would have never done, but absolutely inspired by the energy of the Iranian people, the youth who fearlessly fought for an idea of democracy. I no longer wanted to put this shield between art and activism, etc. I decided that all of this was bullshit, that all this time I thought, being political is tabooed, being politically active is tabooed, but I could care less. So I started to work hard in collecting petitions from celebrities, all kinds of people to help prisoners, all kinds of things. So this transformation for me became really significant in a way that I saw a new page take place, and I actually made an entire body of work called The Book of Kings, which really sort of directly captured the essence of Arab Spring and the Green Movement. And actually, I ended up going to Egypt. So finally, the point I would like to make, since then, I'm not as active, but my work continued to be charged. I continue to live in exile or whatever, maybe by choice, because who knows, maybe I go there and they don't trouble me, but I have a feeling they'll visit me. But the point is, what I would like to get across today is that I'm not just a politically charged artist. I'm also emotionally charged artist. By certain circumstances have been very personal. So there are times where political issues become deeply personal. And I think this radically differs from Western artists, where they live in democratic society, where you have freedom of expression, where the issue of wanting to be political or not is a matter of choice. And I want you to consider tonight that the artists who live in societies where it's not democratic and there is no freedom of expression, and if you're living inside, you have censorship, and if you're outside and you're critical, you're subjected to a life in exile. It's a completely different reality. For me, it's two-channel. I suffer extreme anxiety and extreme sense of longing and sense of displacement and abandonment since being young, which is a core of who I am in my character, and I was just telling that to my cousin tonight, who's with me. And also, I'm rationally, politically at rage with a government who is unjust, has been unjust. I hope it will change its course. He's been atrocious, and oppression, and everything that doesn't just concern me, but concern all the people I care about, my country. So what we're talking about is the impossibility of some artists to have that, to be immoral almost, to be distancing themselves from issues that are so profoundly important. And I suppose myself and many Iranians I know were not able to find that kind of moral distance from the issues, which I think it's possible in the West. Having said that, being who I am as an Iranian artist and most Iranian artists, it's a mixed blessing because it's true that our hands are tied, we have censorship, we are subjected to a very difficult life outside, and at the same time, we're oddly really empowered because our art transcends above and beyond any form of commodity, any form of a practice that just ends up for a museum of galleries. Our work is a deep, profound form of communication with our people. In fact, culture is central to our political discourse. In fact, artists are a threat, such as myself. You wouldn't think so, but I would be. So it was enough to keep me outside. So in many ways, the artists from places like Iran, Egypt, other politically troubled countries are the voice of the people. And I want you to consider that as we go on, but I also want you to consider is that we don't choose to be political. Life brings that on. You cannot not respond to the world that you inhabit, to not have the sense of consciousness, to be quiet. And it was, for myself, I would have to say, I am not interested to be out in the streets screaming, crying to be, I don't even like the word activist, but I find it literally impossible to be quiet when I see my friends in prison, etc. Now, the last thing I wanted to say is that one of the reasons I moved to cinema, which, as some of you know, I started with photography, moved to video, and in 2009, I had my first film, Woman Without Men. And I realized that unconsciously, my move towards cinema was also artistically that it is closer to the people, that it is this activist in me who wants to be more grassroots, who wants to be closer to the people who are normally not that accessible to galleries and museums. That storytelling, the way in which we can bring art closer to the people. So this is no longer to do with Iran, but this is to do with my point of view, my position as an artist, that culture has to be absolutely morally conscious and closer to the people. And on that note, I want to say that if you look at my work, it's always conflicted between work that are crying out about most existential issues of a human being, regardless of being a woman, Iranian, or whatsoever, really, really dealing with existential issues, and yet with work that is deeply rooted in history, political reality, and issues that are above and beyond a single person. So I would like to show you my most recent project I hope to be able to shoot is a film about Umm Kulthum, the artist, the legendary Egyptian singer, who I think sort of fits my criteria as someone who was both a fantastic artist who lived in until 1979, whose work threw you in that mystical space, but yet she was a nationalist, she was politically mobilized, she was she worked very closely with Nasser, the social revolution, etc. And then I would show you about 5-minute clip of Rapture, which really sort of moves completely away from any political issues. And then I hope we can continue with our conversation. So for the moment, you will be with the beautiful music of Umm Kulthum. This is just a 3-minute mood book that I have created for the investors to. I want to just mention before I show this piece that I'm so delighted Susan Dehim is here tonight, who has been a long collaborator and composed music for several of my films, including what you're about to see, and she was actually some of the images. I think she's somewhere here in the. It's the Maria. Anyway, so I'm going to just, because I don't want to take too much time, this film, Rapture, which is a part of the collection of the Broad Foundation, is one of my favorite films that was shot in Morocco in 1999, and Susan did the music. And again, you see that this piece, although it's ethnically specific to Islamic culture, it really does take a more lyrical and poetic direction, just to share with you another perspective. So.
So do you mind if I start? I have some questions. It's so interesting to me when I see Shirin's work because of the contrast, the visual contrast that you create sort of universally across your photographs, the videos, the films. But it's interesting to me that much of what I read and what people talk about is feminism and the gender role, that they believe that this contrast is symbolizing, but yet you don't actually say that when you speak about your work. So I'm just, can you talk a little bit about that? Are we misunderstanding that, or?
I mean, it's very interesting when men make work about men, they don't call them masculinist, but when women make work about women, they call it feminist. I mean, I obviously am a woman, and I see everything from the point of view of a woman, and I think what I like about being a woman is, and I think what the work manifests is this sense of duality, the fragility and the emotionality, and yet the strength. And I think that that's so much about who I am, I think, as a person, and what I think women are in general, in the way that I think women are incredibly powerful, but also very fragile. And I think my work in the way it goes between the very rational and political, in the way that it goes to very emotional stuff, it's definitely from the point of view of a woman that sees everything in that kind of binary tendency. And so if you can call that feminine, but I think feminist, I'm not sure.
Right, right. It's very interesting because when we sought out Shirin for a program that we had, and we used the word activist, and in knowing Shirin and learning from her over the last year, she helped me understand something about that word. And that's actually what I would consider what I used to call environmentalism, or the greening of something, which was sort of a first generation. And it really, and it helped me understand Bob Rauschenberg better, which was really about, awareness or inspiration to use art to communicate better. So it's just interesting because you've sort of, you don't actually like the term activist.
I don't, because I'm not really. I was for a short time. I really was doing what an activist would do in a very organized way, to literally do something, not just, talk about it. But other than that period, again, in 2009 up until 2010, where most Iranian people who never been participating in any kind of protest found themselves, even in Iran, where people normally would never do such a thing. It was an unusual, unprecedented event in the history of modern Iran, where this many people inside and outside came out. So it was just not possible for you to not do that. And we were so excited by this euphoric feeling that we all had, this possibility of democracy, you know, that wasn't going to change just their lives, but my lives. And unfortunately, this was followed by an incredible feeling of despair because, as you know, the government sort of overtook the situation and they basically seized the movement. And a lot of people like myself and my colleagues really felt, yeah, a lot of despair because we felt defeated and that hope was really not real, maybe. I'm still hoping that's not the end. But so that's the extent that I went. And mm-hmm. now I'm back to like the project that you asked me, just to point out that Christy and the foundation asked me to, as an artist that they commissioned, to do a work of art or a series of work that they would commission and that you would devote the profit of the work to a not-for-profit organization that the artists would choose. And since I've been in Egypt, I suggested that I would make a group of work in Egypt.
Oh, you have to tell them the story. This is a beautiful story.
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, I have some images to show you of my photographic work, which when I look back, The Woman of Allah and The Book of Kings, which I will show you very briefly, they seem to be a series of portraits that try to capture a part of Iranian history. The Woman of Allah was the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the Book of Kings about the 2009. And all of the people I photographed were basically performing. Some of them were actually activists, but they were playing a role. When Christy asked me to do this work, I went to Cairo, and I usually work with a photographer, Larry Barnes, who's an American, and I was trying to find out what theme I would approach. It turned out that Larry lost his 22-year-old daughter in that August of last year, just by pure accident. And he was in the state of mourning. And I really felt strongly that we got to take him out. We have to take him to another culture where he could maybe just have a distance from this grief. But we arrived in Cairo when the people of Egypt were also grieving because of the loss of revolution, the atrocities that followed, the fall of hope, I think, more than anything else. There was an overwhelming sense of despair. So I decided to focus this session of photographs to the feeling of loss, whether it's personal loss or national loss. And for the very first time, I decided to photograph real people as opposed to models. So we set up a studio at a not-for-profit organization in Cairo called Townhouse, and with Larry and one of the local guy who's the janitor of the building, who's an older man. And I asked him if he could recruit some of the elderly men and women who actually were right around Tahrir Square, very poor. They came one by one, and I was really interested to photograph older people because all the previous work were all about youth, because they sort of convey that sense of wisdom, the passage of time. And one by one they came, and we tried to share with them the experience that Larry had just had, the loss of his child, and the experience that I've had as an Iranian who's been for so long in distance from family and the pain that I had. And I asked them in their own language if they would be so kind to share with us a moment of tragedy, loss, whether it was personal or national, that they had experienced in life. And they just convey that to the camera. And again, these were like not actors, not these were real people right off the street and extremely poor, hardworking. And one by one, they began to cry. And they, as they gazed at the camera after we told our story, then Larry cried, I cried, and they cried. And it was this tremendous sharing of experience of pain. Again, some of them cried because they lost a child, and some of them maybe because of what had transpired in Egypt. Because we're on this subject, I just go to this quickly. I won't stay very long. Again, this was the woman of Allah that portrayed, that covered the Islamic Revolution, the role of women in that revolution. I posed for a lot of the photographs myself. Obviously, about the violence that was generated. The Book of Kings in 2009, that covered the Arab Spring and, of course, the Green Movement. These are people witnessing the revolution, and these are people who were the activists, who were the soldiers, who fought the people power. The hand on their heart was the Pledge of Honor, which is universally so. I wrote all these texts, and that were poetry by Iranian contemporary poets about the revolution, about such subjects. And as you can see, there were young, beautiful faces from Iran, from all over the Middle East. And
were the texts the ones that you pulled off the internet? Is that
no,
or was
this,
it on the masses?
No, this all of these texts were actually literature from Iran.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
The people were both Arabic and Iranian. Then these were the people of power, the villains that I actually painted on their bodies, images from the Book of Kings from 10th century by Ferdowsi, which was equally tales of heroic tales of people who fought for their nation and atrocities that followed, the beheading, the war, the violence that always seems to be intersecting the idea of activism and courage of fighting for your nation. These are some of the accompanying images. Then I went to Egypt. So these are some of the images I was talking about. Again, this is the first time ever in my history of portrait photography where I actually shoot real people for who they are, that the people are not, they're not representing a culture, but they are actually representing themselves. For the previous people, I think they just played a role. And as you can see, you know, these are average Muslim images of men and women, and yet, you know, sometimes they have negative images in the world for what they look like, how they look. And yet, there's humanity in them for the way they too experience pain and loss. And I did intensive amount of writing with my friends, so it's actually got a lot of calligraphy, you just can't see it. I didn't want to do anything that overpowers the gaze, the images of the people's faces. But as you can see, they project tremendous amount of pain, and this only could have happened if we also opened up with our experiences that we had, again, regardless of where we came from. And I think this was one of the most tremendous experiences I've ever had in my artistic experience that went above and beyond making art, but really where life and art sort of blurred boundaries.
But it's collaborative in sort of a different way,
Think so.
I mean, it's not as if you're collaborating with somebody. You're really, it's somebody very unknown, and the idea of opening up like that, it reminded me that this was where the concept of activism was for Bob, which was that art could help sort of transcend borders, that art could help create a commonality. You know, you start to understand, no matter what culture you're in, no matter what political situation you're in, there's grief. But to be able to convey it and share it that way through these photographs is so powerful.
And I have to say that I think in many ways my work is deeply misunderstood. I see sometimes people introducing me saying, I am someone who's speaking out for example, oppression of women in Islam, or that I am like somehow the ambassador. And I think it's really wrong, because I'm not that. Actually, I think the work is truly very universal. Is that sometimes to be so universal, you have to be so ethnically specific. And that this is all about the humanity of us being on this planet and dealing with different types of people of power and tyranny. And whether is when women versus men at times, but the, you know, the governments, etc. So I think that because of the visual representation of the work and because of the media and the people who cannot transcend past the vocabulary, the visual vocabulary, they reduce it as to political work or a Muslim work or feminist work, where in reality, I don't think it's about that.
I'm going to show a clip now of Bob Rauschenberg, and it relates to a work soliloquy of yours, and it relates to something you said a little earlier about, is it about an artist who's being active within a democratic society or somebody in from a culture which is in conflict, and how that relates. For those of you, watch this, I'm going to do my big AV move here. That was pretty big, wasn't it? The big switch. Bob Rauschenberg in the early 80s decided that there was enough strife going on around the world that he wanted to embark on a worldwide tour. And he didn't go to Paris and London. And, you know, he went to Cuba. He went to Russia. He went to Mexico, Venezuela. He went to cultures that were very challenged. And he wanted to work with the local artists and populations in order to create art, because he believed that art could be a medium that sort of transcended anything else, that it could help communicate across borders, that peacekeeping could be facilitated that way. So this is Bob Rauschenberg with a perm in the 1980s, which is incredibly impressive. And he's talking about Rocky. The first part of it is at the National Gallery, and then I think he's being interviewed by somebody. So I think you should enjoy this.
Like you think of war, peace is somehow non-activity, where war is so wonderful, right?
Because it's highly intentional.
And expensive. Right. Peace can be free. Mm-hmm. And this is just not a good bargain. Nobody wants that. I'm sort of working against most of the politicians in the sense that they want... they can only control if there's a question of power. And I think there would be no need for power if there was communication. And so I've gone from country to country working on that. Started in Mexico at the time that American government was the absolute bottom edge of dealing with Mexico. Now,
let's see. So that's a little introduction to Rocky. And actually, once the Broad opens up, they have a wonderful piece from Rocky that will go in there. But that does give us a sense of, here's an American who grows up in a democratic society and goes out to seek how he can create art in order to do that, versus I think most of your pieces really spring from your experience, having to leave your country, coming back, you know, having a veiled experience when you come back, and even maybe even getting interrogated, how that feels, and that getting translated through your art. Very interesting. But tell us about soliloquy, because that is representative of these two worlds.
Well, actually, I have pictures of it. Soliloquy was, I think, the only work that I did was most autobiographical. But again, from that very poetic point of view, this is, by the way, Possessed, another piece that is in the collection of the Broad Foundation, which I'm very proud of. So, again...
Oh, I have to switch. Watch this.
As I mentioned, that my work seemed to always function in that kind of paradoxical level. Everything is about opposites, you know, about personal and social, political, or mystical and political, and private and public, etc. But this piece was about this point where a woman like myself stands at the threshold of two worlds, East and West, two that are not just different from each other, but in total conflict. And so I had this video that was double projections in two opposite walls, where same woman was constantly navigating. Again, Susanne Dehim did the music, where you literally were making transition between one side and the other. But what I try to do is use architecture as the representative of each culture, really focusing on that. Mm-hmm. As you see in this image, which I shot in Turkey as opposed to Iran, but it was the closest I could get to Iran. It was on the border of Iran and Iraq. This fantastic Islamic architecture, where then we went to Albany, New York, where, you know, we had, I don't remember this plaza, where there's fantastic modern buildings that, again, really represents the grandness of the Western culture, and on. But what happens with, in one side, you had a very capitalistic, more individualistic society, where on the other side, you had this, you know, very, almost, where, you know, very collective, but very oppressive and suffocating. So the whole film was about the experience of someone who's sort of caught in between two worlds that they don't seem to be able to see face to face. And, yeah.
That's very interesting. You know, another interesting thing is your use of the masses, because this comes out in the Book of Kings, where you have the wall of the masses and how they have the Islamic writings versus the tattooing, you know, which is historic and possibly more violent. I mean, really, the only color in that series comes
blood.
Is the blood on the villains, right?
Yeah.
Color is an interesting thing in your work, right? I think it comes out in the knitting, in the film.
Yeah, I'm really a black and white person. Again, talking about the kind of paradoxes that I'm interested in. Red has been very significant. I use red here and there very carefully. In Women Without Men, we shot in color because so much of it was in nature and that. Mm-hmm. But generally, for me, color is very distracting, and I like the severity of black and white.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But sparing use of
yes,
it. Right,
exactly.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to show you one more thing. Let's see if I can figure this out here. This is really about democracy, I think, is sort of my next question. And here we go. We have, this is Bob speaking at the Bork hearings. So this was in the 1980s again. And this is the introduction, so we're only going to take a portion of it, but it's really about Bob defining democracy in his eyes. And I'd be interested to hear what you think about that.
Reality. Controversy is part of creation, and changes are essential to current survival, nationally and therefore internationally. The doors of control should be broad-minded and wise, with experience, compassion, and understanding. This, without doubt, must be the history of the future. In all totalitarian governments, the greatest threats to evil powers have been the philosophers, the artists, the writers, the scientists who represent the uncontrollable conscience, the observers and chroniclers to injustice. Hitler attacked the Bauhaus before starting on the Jews. I worked over the last 6 years in China. The Chinese are changing fearfully and are trying to reconstruct the culture of the thousands of years of philosophy, religion, and art that provided individual self-respect, dignity, and a purpose to life to millions of people. I've traveled and worked in Chile and Tibet and have witnessed the repression of the artists and the intellectuals, and have seen what it has done to the specific and general morale of the entire countries. I've seen the cultural civil war destruction in Sri Lanka and the post-war waste in Thailand. I have just returned from Cuba, which is starving for a free world culture. Art is one of, if not the most, economical exchanges that dissonant ideologies can negotiate with and understand. Everyone is a winner without transgression or translator. Socrates and Plato, as seen on TV yesterday, are an in accord disagreement for their time, but are no more than history. Art cultural evaluations are in the present. Avant-garde has to be publicly rejected as an intrinsic insurance of their newness and value, but legally protected. Back to Bork. The Supreme Court is a...
We'll stop on the Bork thing. I think we missed the first part, but it is interesting where he talks about art being a powerful currency and welcoming the rejection of ideas or going at things that might be quite different.
Well, actually, I don't know if the audience agree with me, but seeing this clip makes me think about how such thing never happens in the art world anymore. We don't see many Western artists standing up, going to the Congress or wherever he was. It just doesn't happen anymore. You know, it's been... The idea of activism as we know it, it doesn't really exist so much anymore in America. I mean, I'm as American now as you are because I've been here longer than I've been in my own country. But when you look at, you know, China, Ai Weiwei, and you look at, you know, all over the world, it seems like, you know, there is a certain amount of comfort that has taken place in culture that in many ways I think the artists are participating in that, because you get immediately marginalized if you're very vocal, if you're really outspoken about a political issue. And I want to be really blunt about this, because from the curators to gallery owners to collectors, they become very suspicious, because often they think artists are being political to be manipulative or to draw attention to themselves. And I think it's very difficult for an artist to sort of, they're very conflicted, because you obviously want to make work that is taken seriously as a work of art, and you don't want to be reduced as the activist.
Right.
But yet you have this moral responsibility to respond something, whether it's environment, whether it's political injustice. You cannot be neutral. But I think, and I don't have the answer, I'm not sure if there's a great degree of comfort, or the fact that the commodification of art, the power and control of economy over the market, over the artwork, has made us numb. I mean, particularly, Christia, I want to be blunt here, because we should be honest. And I think today more than ever, I mean, I've lived in New York since the 80s, and I knew Rauschenberg actually the last phases of his life. But, you know, New York has become this one big corporate art world. Mm. And the values of, you know, you have Francis Bacon selling for $145 million. You have Jeff Koons going for 45, whatever. But there's such a large gap between what is going on in the world and the culture. In the movie, and again, I want to tell you why I went to cinema, of course you have entertainment, you know, where, you know, the art world, the commodity I equal to entertainment. There is a great amount of work being done that is purely on that level of entertainment, but there's a lot of, you know, responsible films that are both artistically valuable but also really, you know, resonate on the time that we live in. I mean, this year you have 12 Years a Slave, you have Act of Killing. The most important films that are being talked about are the ones that really touch people, and emotionally and politically. So why is this not happening in the art world? I have no idea. The artists are becoming richer and richer and very comfortable with... And then there are those who struggle and are not regarded either financially or critically. So I just want to point this out, because I come from a place where Jaffa Panahi, one of our best film directors was in prison, and he went on a hunger strike. He still can't leave the country, and there are many Iranians who know here he's not allowed to write a script or interview or anything. I mean, he has paid a great price for, let's say, supporting the prisoners or showing up in protests. I mean, there's two extremes. I'm not saying all artists should be activists, by the way. I really don't mean that. And I don't think all art should have, you know, any kind of direct relationship to political reality. But I'm just curious whether can we be so immune,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I think we're running way over, and I want to make sure that we have some time for the audience
to reflect on the questions.
Questions. Does anybody have a question for Shirin? We have one over here.
Hi, Shirin. Thanks for coming down to visit us, giving us some of your work from on the West Coast. We miss you. I have a question. When you bring the visual vocabulary that you bring from the East, like a lot of other artists from that side of the world, it has a kind of sometimes somewhat of a feeling that it's so new and so exotic that the meaning sometimes gets kind of lost in there. So how do you pass that challenge, and what's been the response to the forms and the visuals that you bring with that visual vocabulary and trying to pass that boundary and translate the meanings and the sensibility that you want to the audience in the West?
Well, I think you're being a little vague in terms of, is it in relation to the people from Iran or Islamic world or the West? I mean, this question has come up a lot where I think, for example, some Iranians have problem with my work as they feel that it exoticizes the Iranian culture, the Islamic culture. Some Muslims feel that it's critical of Islamic ideology, whatever. Some people feel like it actually celebrates and validates the Islamic Republic. There's almost no way, I guess my answer to you, from the perspective of that part of the world, it's almost impossible for me to walk a path that doesn't disturb one side or the other. Regardless of what I do, it really, I think just the nature of the work and the way that I bring this realistic imagery of the veil or certain iconography that goes back both to Islamic and Persian heritage, they raise a lot of eyebrows. And there's, obviously, I do take a lot of responsibility in my work. I do a lot of research. I don't do it just to sensationalize the subject. But if it is exotic, if, for example, the veil, a lot of people say, you know, you use the veil because it's rather sexy and sensational for the Western gaze. But is it really my problem or the Occident's problem of, you know, it's what people wear, you know? But because I employ that in my work, somehow it seems like I'm orientalizing Muslim. But in fact, it's really, I think the finger should be pointed the other way. In terms of the Western culture, I have also a lot of problem, both on the highest level and the lowest. I mean, the general media reduces my work to the feminist artists who sort of trying to protect the rights of women or like trying to, you know, they absolutely don't see the complexity behind the work. And in fact, the fact that I don't portray these women as the losers, but actually very, very strong beings. And in the art criticism, in, for example, you know, the regular art critics also have problems with it. So what I'm trying to say is that there's no way to win. I mean, I made the film Women Without Men. Either people absolutely hate it or really like it, for whatever it is. Because I just sort of followed my own model, aesthetically, visually, and conceptually. And it's like, it's not perfect. You know, it's not going to satisfy everybody's interest, or you have a different point of view about that political subject, your relationship to that culture. You would have a very different relationship to Iran and your point of view, and therefore you're going to bring that to that work, and I can't control it. The only thing I can do is to be very honest and make sure I do my homework and I know what I'm talking about. The rest of it is like the interpretation of the audience is really not up to me. And yes, I should be accused of this and that, but that's the work I've done, and I take responsibility for it.
The interesting thing is, I think you can't achieve contrast if you were trying to mediate your position. I mean, that wouldn't be effective. And the other thing that's interesting to me is that your work captures history. I mean, you went back, and the veil was sort of reinstituted. It was a very different culture when you left to come to America. You know, I've been in the business of how do you capture history and legacy, and you're really speaking to the experience of a generation. And so people will really look back on this and understand the history of this culture through your work, I think, through the veil and through the writings. So I think it'll prove to be very interesting 100 years from now as people look back on it.
I have a question that I think might be related to the point you just made, and I also am new to Shirin, your work, so I'm very grateful for this opportunity to learn more about it. When I think of American artists whose work might be politically charged, I think of a lot of photographers, especially like documentary photographers. So I'm wondering if you feel that your work has a relationship to that category of representation to documentary, and if so, what that might be.
Well, originally when I started with Women of Allah, I was inspired by photojournalism. And, you know, I was not a photographer, but I really thought the realism that existed in photography and photojournalism, and yet taking that realism and subverting that was really important. You know, I guess I go back to this thing about communication. I think, you know, with painting and sculptures, it's very difficult, for me at least, to convey any form of political message, you know. But I think with photography and film, there is a level of realism that you could use that could make the work more accessible to more general public. I have to say that I found that my photography is very conceptual. And as much as I try to describe the intentions, whatever, it becomes quite abstract. You know, you would really need to know, you know, some of my inspirations or the history of photography to understand why I do what I do. You know, artists taking photographs of themselves. But I find with film that there's no need of that kind of background for the audience, which I enjoy so much. And so for my filmmaking, for example, with the Om Kulsum, I'm using a lot of archival footage because, first of all, we simply can't afford to recreate history. But I really enjoy artistically to sort of integrate the archival footage with my footage that I would shoot. And the same with Women Without Men. We really try to shoot some of the events, real events that took place in demonstrations in Iran in 1953. We created it in Casablanca. So we did massive amount of research and photographic and text to be able to replicate that. So I guess I am, in a way, interested in realism that documentary brings, but there's always this kind of subversive conceptual approach that it's not documentary.
Thank you for being here. Why do you do art?
That's an excellent question. Actually, you know, I'm really glad because I was going to... today, I was talking to my cousin. I was trying to explain and this and that, and she said, you know, I forgot to ask you, why did you stop making art for the 10 years? And I told her, and I thought, at least I tried to tell her, that I got to the point where I found there was no meaning in making art, that I refused to participate in art as a form of career, like as a way of like, oh, you're good at this and this is what you should be doing, that I felt that there was nothing so compelling and urgent for me to put out in the world that anyone should pay attention to or for me to participate in. And now I find it very different. First of all, I find on a personal level, I take culture to the highest level I really consider it something very sacred. For me, art is a way to find meaning in life, to make sense of things. Everything that I don't understand, everything that is the banality of everyday life, it's a way for me to find the moral and emotional faith in the life that I live in. I'm not trying to be, you know, philosophical, but it's really what I do is what I believe. But also, I believe that in terms of communication with the public, I find this profound and very powerful exchange when you make something, whether a film or a work of art, that the audience could look at it and see something in themselves. If it is about your anxiety and your issues that you are able to be naked with, and the audience can look at that and somehow identify, it's really powerful. I think it's very powerful to move people. Because you know what? Every day I try the best I could to have an experience that charges me. Because otherwise, let's be honest, life is really boring and it's hard. And I really think, if I could just be very honest, it's the most meaningful way that I can live my life. Whether it's good or bad or it's just pure stupid, you know, whatever, it could be. It probably is. But it's the only thing I know what to do that cope, that helps me to cope with my own personal angst in life, and hopefully to touch a few people. You know, that's all about I can hope.
I think we have one more here. That was beautiful. Oh my God! One more question here. Okay.
I really like what you say about the cultural gulf that art has with us as Americans, and the way you said it. And a couple of points strike me: the curatorial ambition of Varnado in the 80s exploring high-low in art, and also the sort of shock and awe of our Los Angeles helter-skelter trying to get the culture to engage in this question, I believe. I'm wondering, from an artistic point of view, if its amount of truth-telling that's absent, I believe it is a factor of communication, and I was hoping maybe you'd riff a little bit on that. And perhaps you also would discuss with us curatorial ambitions to correct what, in another art form, a woman wrote a book I really enjoy, and she said, actually, ballet is dead. Is art dead?
You want to start?
you got that one.
I just want to say, you know, being an artist is truly a narcissistic exercise. We make work and we want to be admired. We want to be praised. We want people to say great things. We want people to buy it. We want to... It's fundamentally a practice that it's flawed and it's problematic because it goes down to the root and the foundation of the ego of the artist. So to begin with, an artist has to keep that perspective and understanding that that's what they're battling with, is their own ambition and their own ego. It's like a dancer that keeps looking at herself in front of the mirror and keeps looking at others, wants to look better than everyone else. You can't deny it. There's a competitiveness in this practice that we are in, you know. We all like to be the most expensive, the most successful, etc. It is very difficult for artists to sit back and have this other perspective and say, whoa, wait a minute. You know, like, you know, for example, for me, art practice, professional career was an accident. I told you I left art and then I went to Iran, I made work and somebody saw it. And from then on, it went on and on. And at some point I had to stop it and say, I can't do this anymore. And I went to film. But I'm not trying to blame. First of all, again, I don't think people should be political artists. But I think we should be absolutely morally responsible. Absolutely morally responsible, regardless of where we come from. And I'm afraid being artists today, it makes it very difficult to be conscious of the fact that we are losing that sense of morality. You can still be very successful and desirable, but you do not have to compromise that sense of morality. Again, I'm not talking about political, but even... and so that's one. And the other thing is unfortunately, capitalism. Everything has to be branded, you know, and the artist to refuse to be branded, refuse to participate in this capitalistic world of art. I admire the Broad Foundation for including in their collection politically charged artists, for inviting me, for creating this program. Good for him. He's one of the best collectors we have. There is hope. But I'm just saying that the economy has basically defined the artist's future in this country, and it's at great risk. And I have to say, every time I go to the Middle East, every time I go to Egypt, there's no support. It's, the people are on the edge, the artists working absolutely on the fringes. And yet there's so much energy. No one sells, no one has an outlet. And I must say, I feel sorry for the Western artists. I really do. And I don't mean to be saying this to be controversial, but I don't think we should lose our soul.
It's interesting. I think it also has to do with the support systems. The commercial system is set up with galleries and fairs, etc. And I think it's one area where, you know, there's a growing artist foundation market, and we're all very interested, and we discuss quite a bit, how can we discuss the artistic practice which is not commercial, which is not intended to be sold, which is really about funding source inspiration versus art as a method of exchange, you know. And I think that that's really important. I think that there needs to be a growth in the area to support ideas. I thought I would end with something that I think Bob would be very proud of you and all of the things that you say. These are some words that he had in 1984. I feel strong in my beliefs based on my varied and widely traveled collaborations that a one-to-one contact with art contains potent, peaceful powers and is the most non-elitist way to share exotic and common information, seducing us into creative mutual understandings for the benefit of all. So I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. And
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.